This is a download from Newstalk 106 to 108. To download other programs or for more information, go to newstalk.ie.
On every battlefield, a flag of mercy flies. Its white field bears a red cross, the universal symbol of human compassion. Under that flag, there are no enemies, no racial or religious animosities. There are only brothers. The words of American President Lyndon B. Johnson in 1968. Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. And in tonight's show, we're looking at the history of the International Red Cross on this, the 150th anniversary of the first Geneva Convention about the treatment of wounded soldiers in the field. Then, in the second hour, we'll be bringing you the life and adventures of the man who went from fighting at the Somme to become one of Michael Collins' closest friends and who ended up creating Ardmore Film Studios. We'll be finding out about the life and legacy of the last Jewish monarch, the patroness of the arts, Queen Anne. We'll be hearing about the Cork bishop who threatened to excommunicate any rebel involved in an ambush during the War of Independence. We'll be talking to a man who is making a movie about the 1916 Rising and who wants your help. We'll be discussing the role of the Irish Brigades in wars around the world, from the Wild Geese to the Napoleonic era. And then to end the show, we'll investigate the theft of Charlie Chaplin's body after his death and the attempted theft of Abraham Lincoln's body as we bring you tales of famous corpses. Now, don't forget, if you want to comment on any of our items, you can text the show at any time on 53106. That's for 30 cents. You can call us on our local 1890 number, 453106, or you can email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.ie. Last week, we looked at the history of punishment through the lens of the French philosopher Michel Foucault. And if you want to listen back to that or any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.ie, or go directly to iTunes. Tonight's debate is on the history of the Red Cross. In 1859, the Swiss businessman Henri Dunant witnessed the Battle of Solferino and was so shocked by what he saw, with thousands dead and dying on the battlefield, he set out to change forever how the wounded were treated in war. Thus the idea of neutral humanitarianism was born, and there followed a major conference in Geneva where the Red Cross flag, the inverse of the flag of Switzerland, was officially approved. In 1864, the first Geneva Convention was published, and it was a milestone in the history of humanitarianism, offering care for the wounded and defining medical services as neutral on the battlefield. As countries signed up to the Geneva Convention, national committees were founded, and in 1876, they formed the International Committee of the Red Cross. 5 years later, in 1881, the American Red Cross was founded after some crucial work by Clara Barton. In 1917, the International Committee of the Red Cross received the Nobel Peace Prize for its work during the First World War, and it was awarded it again in 1944 and 1963. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies was founded in 1919 in Paris to enable greater cooperation between Red Cross societies. The Irish Red Cross was formally established in 1939 and this year celebrates its 75th anniversary. Today, the Red Cross movement, with 97 million members worldwide, is the largest humanitarian aid organisation in the world. So in tonight's show, we want to explore the history of the International Red Cross. What effect has it had on wars and conflicts over the past 150 years? And has its impact always been positive? How has it dealt with the changing face of warfare, as well as various controversies over the years? And has it left a lasting legacy? Well, to help me address these questions and more, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Sir Adam Roberts is Senior Research Fellow at the Centre for International Studies in Oxford University's Department of Politics and International Relations. He is also Emeritus Professor of International Relations at Oxford University and Emeritus Fellow of Balliol College, Oxford. An expert on international security, international organisations and international law, among his many publications he has written on the role of humanitarian issues in international politics for the International Review of the Red Cross. Professor Marianne Moser-Jones is a distinguished social historian and public health expert and is a professor in the University of Maryland. She is the author of The American Red Cross, From Clara Barton to the New Deal. Joe Miller is the archivist with the Irish Red Cross and is a member of the Central Council of the Red Cross, and he's been a volunteer with the Red Cross since 1951. Professor David P. Forsyth is the Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He has been a consultant to the International Red Cross and Red Crescent Movement, as well as to the United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Refugees. And he's the author of The Humanitarians, the International Committee of the Red Cross. Well, you're all very welcome. And later in the show, I'll be talking to John Roach, the head of the Irish Red Cross International Department. Well, Marian, I might begin the discussion with you, and maybe we might go back to the very origins of the movement then. Is 1859 the correct starting point?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, you can always go back further and look at antecedents to the Red Cross movement. Certainly, earlier movements for humanitarian or humane treatment of combatants in warfare. And one might also point to Jean-Jacques Rousseau's 1756 treatise in which he really lays the ideological groundwork for the development of the Red Cross movement, saying that once a combatant is out of the battle, that he is a man, and to be treated as a man, as a human being, and not as an enemy. But I think 1859 is the decisive beginning point for the International Red Cross movement, with the Battle of Solferino and Henry Dunant witnessing it.
And what exactly did he see, and why was it so transformative for his own life?
Well, so he was this sort of humanitarian entrepreneur. He was deeply religious and had been involved in organizing YMCA groups as well. And he actually sort of stumbled upon this battle. He was trying to get water rights in Algeria from Emperor Napoleon III. And so he went to see Napoleon III. Well, Napoleon III was slightly busy engaging in this massive battle where French and Sardinian troops faced off against the Austrian troops led by Emperor Franz Joseph. And I mean, this was unprecedented warfare. You had 300,000 combatants coming together in one day in Solferino, in, you know, this what's now northern Italy. And there was a lot of chaos, changing in plans of attacks. And on top of this, you have these advances in the technology of warfare. You have these penetrating conical bullets from the new long-range rifles that just rip through the flesh. And you have, you know, large infantry guns as well. And so you have these massive casualties. I mean, 20,000 were wounded in a day, in 15 hours of warfare. And so Dunant just kind of stumbles upon the scene, if we're to believe his account, and there are these men who are just in agony, screaming out, and you know, sometimes being bayoneted or shot on the battlefield. And what's happened is that the organization of military medicine has not caught up with this advance, if you will, or development in, you know, the organization of massive armies and the technological advance of modern warfare. And so for Dunant, this is a transformative moment because he and some local people organize aid to these wounded soldiers and carry them in wheelbarrows and improvised stretchers to the local church. But they realize that their efforts are so inadequate. And, you know, Dunant has no medical training whatsoever, and there's really just a lack of attention. And so he writes down this experience in a book a memory of Solferino, un souvenir de Solferino in French. And this book is compellingly written, pretty simply written, and he argues that there should be this international standard sort of for the treatment of combatants, that there should be these neutral volunteer societies that could go out on the battlefield and would not be taken prisoner or shot at. Because warfare has gotten so horrific, in his view, and that he also is somewhat cynical in that he doesn't say warfare should be ended altogether. He says, in the, you know, he kind of prophetically understands that these European nation states are going to keep fighting among each other, and that if we're going to be civilized, as Europe claimed to in the 19th century, that we're going to have to somehow make this less inhumane. And so I think, you know, it's if for him personally transformative. He writes about it, and then this compelling book gets shared and distributed all over influential circles in Europe, and then leads to the formation of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Geneva and the creation of the first Geneva Convention.
Very good. Adam, if we go back to that first Geneva Convention, how significant was that? And I suppose it's appropriate that we are having the show on the 150th anniversary of its setting out these key principles.
It was hugely significant. It was the first time there'd been such a humanitarian treaty which was open to all countries to sign, and that dealt specifically with the question of wounded on the battlefield. But I think we would be confusing the picture if we presented it simply as one of suddenly a committee in Geneva, inspired by this one rather unusual and even eccentric businessman, suddenly came up with the idea of international humanitarian law. Because the trouble with that vision is it sort of implies that international humanitarian law is something that comes from do-gooder citizens rather than from the interests of soldiers. And it's quite striking that if you want to start looking at the very first treaty that was open to any state to sign and that did touch on these matters, it might not be the 1864 Geneva Convention that you'd go for, but the Paris Maritime Agreement, which was signed or drawn up by Britain, France, and other powers at the end of the Crimean War, drawn up in Paris in 1856. And that was the first treaty ever that was open to absolutely any country to adhere to in the entire world. And it's interesting that it should have been on an issue of laws of war. It was to do with neutral shipping and what would count as neutral cargoes that could be allowed to proceed during warfare and whatnot, and what types of ships should be stopped and whatnot. And it arose for a very particular reason to do with odd discrepancies between the British and French interpretations of the law during the Crimean War. So it was a problem between allies, between coalition partners as well, that led to that. So there were precedents in the form of earlier treaties dealing with aspects of warfare, albeit a slightly different aspect than the one that the Red Cross came to address. And of course, going back further, there are so many cases of humanitarian laws of war being recognized and understood by governments. For example, Benjamin Franklin, when an ambassador in various European countries for the new government of the United States, concluded treaties on how prisoners were to be treated in warfare with many other states, including Prussia, for example. So there was a background in terms of solid interest of states and their armed forces, willingness to conclude treaties, which preceded the 1864 convention, but I fully agree that the 1864 convention marks a significant step forward in that process.
And David, then you see, I suppose, well, first of all, maybe we might talk about the decision to take that as the emblem. Is it as simple as just taking the Swiss flag and reversing the colours, having it as a white background and a red cross? And then, of course, you have the red crescent develops as well for other countries. How did that come about?
Well, it has been remarked already that Henri Dunant was an evangelical Christian. He was very much a crusader for the Christian faith, and the roots of the Red Cross movement really lie in the notion of Christian charity. This very much animated Dunant. Later, it was said that particularly the International Committee of the Red Cross, as well as other Red Cross agencies, were not faith-based organizations. They were not religious, and that the emblem of a Red Cross on a white background was simply the reverse of the Swiss flag, and the Swiss government was the host that called the first Geneva Conference. I do think that the Red Cross emblem has a lot to do with the cross in Christianity, but as the movement spread, as in particular the Ottoman Empire became involved in various conflicts, it did not wish to use the Red Cross because it certainly saw the Red Cross emblem as linked to Western Christianity. And so from the 1870s, you get the introduction of the Red Crescent, and it becomes rather obvious that if one is going to have a global humanitarian movement, one is going to have to move beyond the Red Cross on a white background. Regardless of whatever the facts were at the origin of the emblem, various parties up until today do see, rightly or wrongly, the Red Cross as linked to Western Christianity. And this has become recently ensnared in the whole question of Israel and the Israeli Aid Society. And so now, from the era of 2005-2006, you have a third emblem, a third official emblem adopted by states. So you have a Red Cross, a Red Crescent, and now a kind of red crystal, which, when used by the Israeli Aid Society, then allows it to be incorporated into the what is still called the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement.
Excellent. Joe, you see the establishment of various national Red Cross committees and agencies in the years ahead. They all seem to have a certain amount of autonomy. There is a certain amount of fragmentation. And that seems to have kind of worked against having a coordinated international approach, it seems.
Well, I think the Red Cross movement, the Red Cross network, has always been fragmented. There has always been a strong dose of nationalism in the Red Cross family or in the Red Cross world. And one saw this right away. I think the chink in Dunant's vision, the problem, the weak spot in Dunant's vision of universal humanitarianism that would be neutral, was evident right away in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, in which the Prussian Aid Society was not neutral. The French Aid Society was not neutral. They supported their armies, their side. And right away, shortly after the First Geneva Convention, one did see that national volunteers, when put into the field, were not necessarily neutral, particularly when their own countries were engaged in fighting. And this, in fact, opened up some opportunities for the International Committee of the Red Cross to become more of an actor in the field, on the ground. The original idea by the gentlemen of Geneva forming the committee in Geneva, which actually did not originally use the name of the Red Cross, but considered itself a kind of sanitation committee and only later adopted the Red Cross as part of its title. These people originally thought, well, we'd be a warehouse, we'd be a communication center, we'd be a backstop, and it would be the national volunteer agencies, let's say like the Irish Red Cross, that would do the actual work in the field. But if one was going to have neutral humanitarian operations in the midst of conflict, then maybe it worked better to have what was originally the All-Swiss International Committee of the Red Cross play this neutral role, and from time to time they would be supported and helped by various national Red Cross societies. But it's very difficult to be neutral when one's colleagues are being killed, when one's country is under attack. But Switzerland, permanently neutral since, I suppose, 1815, was in a position to, if you will, be more neutral in the midst of conflict, or most conflicts, than would be various national Red Cross societies like originally the Prussian Red Cross, French Red Cross, etc.
Very good. Joe Miller, we're going to go to a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking to John Roach as well, who's done such brilliant work for the Irish Red Cross. Talk to me about the Irish context, because it seems, even though it was founded in 1939, so that's 75 years ago, it seems to have been elements of it around beforehand, and you had an Irish White Cross in the 20s. And you had, so how much was there beforehand, before 1939?
Well, I want to just continue by saying in 1929 the Irish Free State became party to signed up to the Geneva Convention, allowing a Red Cross to be established in the state. Now, in those, the British Red Cross established itself here about 1907, and they set up branches in 12 counties in Ireland. They were joined by the St. John Ambulance Brigade, who were here much longer. They were here in the 1880s, believe it or not. And they operated first aid services and trained people in first aid. The Red Cross then, when the state was established in 1922, the British Red Cross had to kind of step aside, but not leave the state. They had, in fact, offices in Merrion Square and manned and administered hospitals that were set up here during the First World War. A famous one still standing is Leopardstown Park Hospital. And these were for the war wounded. There were a number of other large houses also in the state. And the St. John Ambulance Brigade then, jointly with them, continued to administer a presence in the state here.
Brilliant. OK, well, we're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll continue with our discussion of the International Red Cross. We'll talk about its role in the First and Second World War and also explore the evolution of the Irish Red Cross. So stay with us here on News Talk.
Talking History with Patrick Gagan on News Talk 106 to 108.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. As we discuss the history of the Red Cross, I'm joined on the phone by Professor Adam Roberts, Professor Marianne Moser-Jones, and Professor David Forsyth, and in studio by Joe Miller. And I suppose maybe, Marianne, we might talk about the development then of the American Red Cross first, and the role that Clara Barton played in that.
Yes. So it was an unusual story in that the American Red Cross was a latecomer to the Red Cross movement. The United States was the 32nd nation to sign the 1864 Geneva Convention. And in fact, the United States had sent a representative, an observer, to the original conference, but the U.S. was engaged in a civil war. In the U.S. Civil War during the time, and for years after, was occupied with Reconstruction, sort of healing, post-war healing. And so Clara Barton had actually been a volunteer aid worker in the U.S. Civil War, She had been a patent clerk in Washington, D.C., and as much of many of the battles had taken place in Virginia, right near Washington, she had sort of taken it upon herself to go out and help people, to help the army, the Union Army. She was not neutral. And sort of like this unusual character, Henri Dunant, who we've been talking about, she was sort of a humanitarian entrepreneur. She decided to found, to form a little group that would help on the battlefield, help wounded soldiers. She got a lot of support from her native Massachusetts. And she became quite famous, actually, because she had this reputation, unlike many others who supplied a volunteer aid, for running out onto the battlefield and for actually endangering herself in order to help wounded soldiers. So she had this reputation, and some of it was inflated by the press of the day, who were found it somewhat unusual for a woman to be out there on the battlefield, and by her own stories. She was a great storyteller, and she made quite a bit of money for a woman of those times on the lecture circuit then, which was sort of their forerunner to what we might, we have the TED Talks now, they had the lecture circuit. And she collapsed during one of her lectures because she was exhausted, and her doctor suggested that she go to Switzerland to recover. And so she went to Geneva, to Lake Geneva, and was staying with a family of a Swiss consul, and she met some of the founders of the Geneva-based Red Cross movement, and they sort of spoke with her about potentially going back to the United States and founding a Red Cross movement. And eventually she did, she had trouble getting people to be interested in it, though, because at the time, the United States was not a military power. The Americans were not interested in forming volunteer aid societies to prepare for war. There were ongoing skirmishes, and there was warfare in the West with Native Americans, but there was not the same kind of international conflict that was going on in Europe at the time. So eventually she came up with the idea that the American Red Cross in peacetime would aid in what she called national calamities, natural disasters, of which the United States has many now and has always had: tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes, fires, floods. And back then there were quite a few epidemics. And this idea took hold in the popular imagination a little more than the idea of a neutral volunteer aid society did, because in this post-Civil War climate, Americans really didn't even want to think about preparing for another war.
And sorry, Mary, and there seemed to be controversy towards the end of her time there over the management of the funds.
Yes. So she was the president and founder of the American Red Cross, and she served for 23 years until her early 80s. And after the Spanish-American War, which was the first major war in which the American Red Cross was involved, there was an investigation by Congress into the activities of the American Red Cross, because it had been just a very small organization, and it had really not been prepared to provide aid to the U.S. Army and to Cuban civilians and others during the war. And Barton had not managed it well. She was a great entrepreneur and visionary, but she was not a great manager of either funds or people. And so, in fact, the investigation revealed that she'd just sort of given the funds to this person and that person and not kept the books well, and that it was kind of a mess. And some people accused her of embezzling funds and living off the Red Cross. That was never proven, and my own archival work suggests very strongly that there's nothing to that, that in fact she just mismanaged the funds very poorly. the organization was in need of reorganization, and so she was swept out. She was ousted at the age of 83 from the organization, and a whole new progressive era leadership came in that was supported by President Teddy Roosevelt. And they reorganized the American Red Cross, and they made it much closer to the American government and what was then the War Department. And that sort of set the stage for the organization's involvement in the First World War.
Very good. Okay. Now, earlier in the week, I spoke to John Roach, who's the head of the Irish Red Cross International Development, because we wanted to find out about how it developed in this country. And my first question to him was about how, in fact, it did develop, when it started, and how.
Predated to that, before the War of Independence, you would have had the branches of in Ireland of the British Red Cross linked when it was established a long time ago. And I think we even had four or five branches here in Dublin, which actually were involved in the 1916 rising, the GPO. Actually, a famous guy, Neville Shute, who was then known as Neville Norrie, who wrote the famous book, Town Called Alice. Actually, his father was working in the post office and he was involved himself and got involved with the Red Cross, providing relief assistance. Then in 1939, of course, the birth of the Irish Red Cross as part of Oireachtas was set up officially, but would have sort of transformed, there would have been branches of the old part, which would have been the British Red Cross. And we would have had people active quite all over. From its inception, the Irish part, it's been quite active in many aspects throughout Ireland, providing emergency relief assistance and also playing its role, because, of course, the Red Cross is part of one of the biggest humanitarian networks in the world. It plays both a role internationally and nationally. Nationally, the milestones we can talk, where there would be a crossover even with their international presence, would have been around the World War II, where the Irish Red Cross, on its international side, built a hospital in Normandy in St. Lo, where famous Samuel Beckett himself was actually a volunteer. And he was a translator and a driver. And I think he even wrote a poem, one of his poems dedicated during that time. And just shows you the breadth, how people get involved. It's people from all different walks of life. At the same time, at home, what it was doing during World War, just before that, of course, the famous Strand bombings, North Strand bombings, the Red Cross volunteers were out on that night providing shelter and support and emergency support in the Mansion House and to people whose houses had been destroyed during that terrible time, and then again helping the emergency services to treat sick and wounded. Also, then, as I said, during the Second World War, the Irish Red Cross was quite active at home, not only abroad. We had what is called the famous Operation Shamrock, where 1,000 kids from all over, from Germany, from France, from Ireland, who had been caught up, you can imagine, only now when the world has changed and we see wars, we can see it when it happens straight away. In those days, you can imagine the trauma of that. So these kids were brought to Ireland and they were housed. Initially was supposed to be for a few months, like a sort of a holiday, but ended up spending a couple of years because a lot of the kids were quite traumatised. And only last year there was a historic, and they were housed down in Wicklow, which now is the Glencree Reconciliation Centre that used to be a hostel. And the Red Cross looked after these people for a long time, providing even some Red Cross families had taken in people who had been involved in the Red Cross, took some of these kids in, and they lived for a couple of years during the Great War.
Did they ever have a reunion?
They did. Some of the people came over last year, and I think from time to time even relatives of them, you know, their children and grandchildren come over, and they remember that remarkable time growing up, that, you know, that their parents had remembered, or their grandparents, of that tragic time in their history.
So what about then in the 1950s and in the 60s and the 70s? What role would the Irish Red Cross have played then?
Of course, again, it's only when in crisis. I mean, the Red Cross is always around and it's always in the community, and we are well known in Ireland for, of course, providing at the Letta Brent of Ireland first aid services. We can call upon people when a crisis, so it's usually only when a crisis happens that's when you see at the forefront. Unfortunately, that's the nature of the beast of this organisation, but again, I think, you know, that's the humanitarian mandate it has. There have been a number of benchmarks. I think one, we would have known the agency Goethe. I mean, back in the 60s, Ireland had a campaign for hunger, which was mandated to the Red Cross by the government, and that also started development, international development, where this campaign actually collected money and was used abroad in particularly Africa, and that later on became, this agency grew into what is we know today as the organisation GERTA, the Blood Transfusion Service. It was Red Cross volunteers who, from the Irish Red Cross, who started to collect blood and started to organise, and then again this became a state. And this is what the Red Cross does around the world. It sort of finds where there's a gap, and it provides a service, and then, you know, it's not that it wants to keep that service going, but it's happy when someone takes the responsibility and then takes. So we've done a number of things, and another sort of historic part would have been for us would have been probably we set up the first Irish water safety campaign back in the 70s, which now later on became the Irish Water Safety Authority. So the Red Cross has always been sort of, as it is from the community, makes those benchmarks or finds a gap, and is, as I said, is in the background, is there when times of crisis, that people are mobilised to help in these times.
And you're with the Irish Red Cross for, I think, 20 years. What led you, what inspired you to join?
Well, I got sort of kidnapped in one sense. I was involved with the Scout movement, and in the days of regulation of everything, I had to do a first aid course to be responsible with child protection and issues that, you know, at least someone knew if one of the kids had an accident. And I did a first aid course. Little did I know that would bring me onto a career where I got involved as a volunteer with the Red Cross, and later on then to be a development officer, where then I became one of its international delegates in the early 90s, where I ended up, after doing a training course, a few weeks later after the training course, I found myself in South Sudan.
In that 20 years, you've gone on to become the head of operations for the Irish Red Cross, dealing with the national and the international programmes. What are the crises in particular that have stood out for you, and in a way, how has the Irish Red Cross been able to handle them?
Well, I think, probably in my own experience, probably the most traumatic, and it could have had a different effect on me, would have been the famine in Somalia in 91-92. I was a young delegate in south of Somalia, and we were right in the height of the famine. And it was a very difficult place because there was no government, it was total anarchy, you had gangs, it was extremely difficult to bring food. And it was my first experience of seeing where basically every truck of food I brought in, I filled it with bodies taking out. So that's why I said it could have been a turning point, that it would have traumatized me that I wouldn't do this work, but I think it motivated me. And I think why it's significant is because Ireland played a huge role during that time. I mean, first with Charlie Bird from RTE, who came over, who highlighted where the world, because of course at the same time you had the Balkans War had started, and you had at the same time also a situation in Rwanda where the eyes of the world were looking somewhere else. And this was really, and we had then our foreign minister at the time, David Andrews, who later on became, later in life, to be the chairman of the Irish Red Cross. He was the first foreign dignitary to actually come to Somalia, and then later on he brought President Mary Robinson, who made that passionate speech in the UN. So again, it was great to see how linking, again, we had many delegates from the Irish Red Cross during that crisis. Another probably crisis would have been the Balkans. Again, this was probably a war. A lot of people would have known the Balkans from being on holidays, former Yugoslavia. Many people would have known, oh, you go Croatia, they would have known Montenegro. To go and see this beautiful place and how it got destroyed. I think later on, where Irish troops were involved, we, the Irish Red Cross, had played a significant role in having many delegates, I think. And for the first time last week, I was just at the retirement of one colleague who had been 21 years since the Balkans had started as a conveyor. Because in those days it was very difficult because of the complications of front lines. You couldn't have a Croat driving across a Serbian front line, so we had to introduce expatriate truck drivers. And he started what he thought was a 3-month mission and ended 21 years later still working in the Red Cross. I guess also recently, probably the big crisis, I mean, one of the crises we've been dealing with is the tsunami. I mean, it was a bit unprecedented. Of course, the scale of it, again, I think it took the world because of the time that it happened. But for the Irish Red Cross, it changed us because we had raised so much money within a very short space of time. I mean, I think we raised over 30 million. And this involved us then where we had, again, I would say again, we were back engaged on an international front, running our own programs where we built hospitals, we rebuilt people's homes, and more direct involvement, which we would have been doing doing back in the 40s and the 50s and probably wouldn't have been recognised with. And I guess today, the real crisis on our hands, and it's probably going to be around for the next 10 to 15 years, is the Syrian crisis. And this, the impact of this is tremendous. I mean, nearly 3/4 of the population are in need of humanitarian assistance. They live under extremely difficult conditions. Not only impacts on Syria, but the surrounding countries. And we, the Irish Red Cross, are involved in a programme where we're looking at to support Syrian families to come here and to be assisted. Already a programme that is set up by the government. So we do all this stuff in the background. Again, it's not, you know, that's the Red Cross is, in a sense, is modest sometimes, but that's it. We are there when there's crisis, and not all of our work is ever seen on the forefront, only when there is a crisis happening.
Okay, well, my thanks to John Roach, the head of operations for the Irish Red Cross, for bringing all of those stories to the front of this programme. And we'll be back after the break when we're going to continue by talking about the history and the great work of the Red Cross. So stay with us here on News Talk.
Talking History with Patrick Gagan on News Talk 106 to 108.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we look at the role of the International Red Cross. David Forsyth, when we look at the role of the Red Cross in the First World War and the Second World War, I know it won the Nobel Peace Prize each time towards the end of those conflicts, but there have also been some criticisms of some of its actions, in particular in the Second World War, and that maybe it didn't do enough. In that case, you had the Holocaust, you had the German Red Cross refusing to cooperate on some issues. How would you assess its role in those conflicts?
Well, I'd say that the Red Cross movement as a whole did quite heroic work in both World Wars, but particularly in the First World War, it has an outstanding record. This is certainly true of the American Red Cross, which had lots of personnel, and relatively speaking, it was well-funded, and the American Red Cross and the rest of the Red Cross movement was very active after World War I, staying in Europe and dealing with all sorts of uprooted persons, whether today we would call them refugees or internally displaced or ex-prisoners of war. There were just lots of people in Europe after World War I, and the Red Cross worked with the new League of Nations and with others, and really did quite commendable work. The record in World War II is more controversial, I think, particularly for the International Committee of the Red Cross, even though it was, as you noted, awarded a Nobel Prize again after the war. The big issue here is whether the International Committee of the Red Cross, in its quiet diplomacy for detainees, did enough for German Jews and others who were victimized by the Nazi regime. And I think now there's a consensus that on that particular issue, working quietly behind the scenes, as it often does, to try to help victims of violent politics, they did not do enough to help German Jews and others who were not only victimized and persecuted by the Nazis, but as we now know, actually made the victims of genocide. The ICRC debated in 1942 whether to make a public statement about treatment of what were then called those deported, deportees, which was code for largely Jews. And there were other issues involved in that debate, but in the last analysis, the committee, under some pressure from Swiss officials in Bern, decided not to go public. That's a very complicated issue, in part because the International Committee of the Red Cross had ongoing work visiting prisoners of war. The Nazis were cooperating to a certain extent in protecting British military personnel, American military personnel who had been captured. There was, of course, brutality on all sides, but there was some reasonable application of the 1929 Geneva Convention on Prisoners of War. The ICRC was in the middle of all of that, and there the argument is that if they had gone public, then the Nazis might have pulled out of those prisoner of war operations. But on the question of quiet diplomacy and whether the ICRC should have done more to try to protect German Jews and others who were not covered by the Geneva Conventions. There, I think, even the ICRC has said that it should have been more vigorous, it should have been more diligent. It had bits and pieces of achievements in occupied Hungary and at the end of the war with getting some relief into the concentration camps and death camps. But I think it's now generally acknowledged that for whatever reason, and we can discuss the reasons if you want, the ICRC was not as vigorous in its quiet diplomacy as it should have been in behalf of those who were being victimized by the German Holocaust.
Adam, war has changed a lot in the, well, I suppose, in the past 100 years. And you have, I suppose, the kinds of conflicts you have now around the world and increasing numbers of civil wars. It makes things, I suppose, more difficult, more challenging for the work of the Red Cross.
I think things have always been difficult and challenging for the Red Cross. I agreed with everything that David Forsyth just said. I thought he was very interesting on the ICRC's failure when it came to the deportation of Jews and others in World War II. But equally, of course, there were real achievements. I've read through many documents and accounts of the ICRC movement, but nothing made quite as big an impression on me. There was once just a chance meeting with a man in Oxfordshire who told me he'd been a prisoner in World War II, a prisoner of war of the Germans, and he had been imprisoned in Poland, which was, of course, the country where many absolutely horrific events to do with the so-called final solution were happening. But he said that the ICRC probably saved his life, that it was ICRC delegates visiting the prison that made a difference and that also brought in food supplies and the like, and he thought they probably had saved his life. And so there are real achievements, even in the middle of a havoc. Now, when I say that it's always been difficult, I think, for example, of the First World War, which was a really serious challenge for the Red Cross movement, not only because of the difficulty that then, as in other times, different Red Cross societies in different countries, as it were, necessarily adopt a somewhat nationalist line, but also the whole nature of war was sort of undermining of the ICRC mission, because the laws of war then, as now, emphasized that war should be limited as much as possible, and that civilians should not be attacked. And then what happens is this extraordinary industrial-scale killing of young conscripts, individually entirely blameless, just hauled into the trenches and killed on a huge scale. And so the project of humanizing war, which is what was associated with the ICRC, took a really big blow. And the relevance of laws of war seemed minor when, in a sense, this industrial killing wasn't contrary to existing laws of war. They were killing other soldiers, which was just what the laws of war said they should be doing. So there was a huge blow to the ICRC principles, and it was with difficulty in the interwar years that it started to recover and, among other things, started the work of drawing up provisions about the limiting killings of civilians and other matters. But the modern changes in warfare, I think the biggest blow is a very simple one, and it's not even a technical one. It's that war now is overwhelmingly civil war. And there is a real problem with civil wars where you don't have symmetrical armies slugging it out, but you have neighbor killing neighbor, and where the forces tend to be unofficial and not very disciplined. And that's provoked a huge problem for the Red Cross movement, with which it is still coping. And I take my hat off to the heroism of International Red Cross workers who have been attempting to moderate some of the more extreme forms of action in these wars, and in some cases have been assassinated or murdered, killed for their efforts. In Chechnya, for example, there were some such cases. In the former Yugoslavia, there were some, and there have been some more recently. So adapting to new forms of warfare is something that the Red Cross movement has become, sadly, rather familiar with.
Excellent. Okay, Joe Miller, we're almost out of time, but when we look at the legacy of the Red Cross then, what do you think really stands out?
Well, I suppose the membership worldwide, about 6 to 8 million fluctuating. That's a huge legacy. We have taught people worldwide in various countries through the various Red Cross societies not favour a person's colour, religion or politics, but to treat the person impartially. Training people how to deal with disasters, including training youth in first aid. And also the human suffering that's at present around. And I will mention at the moment the Ebola crisis in Somalia, and we're doing our best there. We're sending medical supplies out, and Red Cross people are on the ground. They're a disaster organisation. When the button is pressed, they respond, and Ireland is a giving country to that cause.
Very good. Okay, well, I think that's a brilliant note on which to end our discussion for it. We could have, of course, discussed an awful lot more, but there's only so much you can get through in the hour. My thanks to all my wonderful guests, Professor Adam Roberts of the University of Oxford, Professor Marian Moser-Jones of the University of Maryland, Joe Miller of the Irish Red Cross, Professor David Forsyth of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and earlier, of course, we talked to John Roach of the Irish Red Cross. We have a very interesting show for you next week. We're going to be talking about the Berlin blockade of 1948 to 1949, when the Soviet Union tried to cut off Berlin from the world, and America organized an airlift. I'm just back from Berlin myself. I was there over the weekend, and beautiful city. But we will be talking about one of the pivotal moments in the history of the Cold War next week.
Thanks for listening to this Newstalk 106 to 108 podcast. To download other programs or for more information, go to newstalk.ie.